So Tay and Toshi go here. Yeah, so thanks for coming by.
And thank you for inviting.
I'm glad you guys found the time. So unfortunately, Maya Lin couldn't join us. A last minute sort of change of plans, I guess.
Yes.
But she might call in if we get lucky.
Yeah.
But I think we actually have plenty to talk about anyway. So, but hi to Maya if you're listening.
Hi, if you
shout out to Maya.
Shout out to Maya.
Feeling better. Yeah.
So I have I'm very lucky to have two guests. Toshiko Mori, who is basically a legendary architect and honestly one of the only female Asian architects when I was studying and now looking for that I knew about.
So really?
I think I was trying to count. I think you were one of three, and Maya was one of the other three.
Oh. And Sejima.
And Sejima, basically. Yeah. And then Tay Carpenter, who is basically one of the more exciting young architects in New York City, also an Asian American woman, and also Toshiko Mori's daughter. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of firsts, I think.
Family time.
Yes.
So Tay and I have known each other for a little bit, and originally Tay and I had done a kind of preview of this whole radio show about a month ago, just to see if it was even interesting to talk about Asians in architecture and Asians in design, and luckily it was. And then fortunate, I think, that Toshiko was able to join us, so... I don't know where this is going to go, but I think it'll be interesting.
Yeah. We've never done this before.
No, I've never done interview. This.
Yeah, have you guys ever done any kind of press or anything together?
Nothing, no.
Zero.
Yeah, zero.
Do you guys end up talking about your work together very much, or just other non-work related things when you hang out?
It's mostly.
Mostly.
Non-work.
Non-work.
I was telling Dong it's mostly about the dog.
Yes.
What's his name again?
Mamanosuke.
Mamanosuke didn't make it.
No.
Oh.
I could have. He's Asian.
He's exactly.
He's bilingual, too.
He's a bilingual.
He speaks Japanese.
You could lower the
English.
Mic for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
he's very talkative.
He's from Tokyo.
He is?
A Japanese breed. There's like only six Japanese breed, and he's one of them. Shiba Inu.
Mm-hmm. Does he work out of your office with you?
Sometimes.
If he's on good behavior.
If he's on good behavior.
Do you also have a dog, Tay?
I have a cat.
Oh, does
they don't
cat,
get along.
No.
Mm-mm.
No.
The dog loves the cat, but the cat hates the dog.
Right. Dog admires.
This is mostly what we talk about.
I know, yeah. Dog admires a cat, but cat, it just ignores a dog.
Animal politics.
Yes.
Yeah. But both of you guys live in New York and have your offices in New York, right?
Yes, yeah.
How far apart are your physical offices from each other?
Mine is right up the street on Lafayette and Kenmare. And yours is in Brooklyn.
And I'm in Brooklyn. I'm in Prospect Heights.
Did you guys like divide the city between Manhattan and Brooklyn and like keep some space?
We're fighting
from each
over
other?
Queens.
Yeah. Divide and conquer.
Yeah, you're pretty good. Two out of five boroughs already, right away.
You can have Staten Island. Just kidding.
Queens is really fast growing.
Yeah, you guys can fight over that one.
And you got a waterfront.
I know. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, you got it covered with. Pool.
That's why we're talking to both of you. So whoever owns that piece of waterfront, we'll stay friends with.
Yeah. Does your pool move?
It can, but it's actually because it's not the greatest shape to move through the water.
Oh yeah,
since it's a big plus.
Yeah,
We are designing it not to move.
Oh, I see.
Like you can tug it around if you really need to, but
right, it's hard.
It's hard. So the idea was actually build it as a permanent thing and then build more.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, seems simple. So I'd love to hear, I think, even just as mundane as it might be, what your work entails as, like, even this week, I think, for people that are... Because the kind of goal for this is a lot of people that are either early entry into architecture or design or art creative things in general, or don't even know that you could be an artist and make money from it. So what did you do this week, Toshiko?
This week I
get ready, Dong.
What did you do today?
Wow, this week is like I did a lot of things that doesn't make money, but I hope I can contribute to a certain role of architects in society. Because over the weekend I was in Dubai, and I'm in a global future council of cities and urbanization for World Economic Forum. This is a group of global experts, about 700 of us. And we discuss global issues from energy to cybersecurity to politics to job scarcity to even space technology, long-term investment. And then my council discusses effects of cities and urbanization globally. So it's a very interesting group. I think I'm the only architect on a council. It's very strange. And many of us city policy people, planners, actually Tay's best friend's mom was there.
And she's and a husband, another best friend's husband.
Her best friend's husband, Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, who's an executive editor of Foreign Affairs. He was there moderating a session on new geopolitics. So it's really huge and tenable issues and how cities and urbanization can intersect. So I'm encouraging my friends in architecture to join the conversation. First, it's nerdy, and it's kind of, you know, it's not about design, but it does affect design a great deal, so decision makers. And like I was talking to two people, one manages a Japanese pension fund, which is one of the largest pension funds in the world, and then a gentleman who manages sovereign fund of Singapore, the two largest. I'm asking them, how do you invest? Why can't you invest in infrastructure? And what does it make it able for your mega fund to fund infrastructure? Like your pool should qualify as an infrastructure. But they were saying that it only look at the funding for 10 years. But Singapore, for example, came up with strategy to be able to invest in project-based. So in the long run, as an architect, we really have to know who's investing in the future of a built environment and how does it work, and to be able to be in a place to discuss that. And I think it's my responsibility if I'm giving an opportunity to be there to discuss that. So the day before yesterday, I came back.
And is this conference convened once a year? Are you there more often?
Once a year, usually. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing it for about 10 years in different design council, design innovation, but cities and urbanization can intersect more with many diverse group of people.
And have you seen in the 10 years that have been on this conference, actions taken as a direct result of the discussions in the conference?
Yes, and I think it can make a difference. That's what's very interesting. And also one can learn from each other what are the biggest risks are, thinking about it, so you can plan much more proactively, just not immediate issues, but huge issues. Like,
and you were saying this is through the World Economic Forum?
Right, right.
Is this a conference that's open to the public?
No, it's a private conference. Takes place annually in Davos. It's incredibly privileged, 1% kind of thing. But I think our role is to bring up agendas, which is like pressing in the world. As you can imagine, 99% is going to really rule the world eventually, and then causing divisiveness and fragility, instability. So 1% can't just sit around, and I think it has changed a great deal to be able to understand the effects of migration, effects of populism, why it's happening, inequality of income, inequality, of course, climate change is a huge issue, and job opportunities, imbalance in job opportunities between rural environment and urban environment. So, and then I came back, and then I worked in the office.
That was Sunday.
No, I came back on Tuesday morning, and I went straight to the office, and then I worked on different projects. Everybody's lined up, and, you know. And
were they just waiting for you to come back to?
No, they're working. They ignore me. They just have to keep on working. And then yesterday, I was working in the morning, and some phone calls, and I was host and introduced Anna Heringer last night at Cooper Union Architectural League organized lecture series on current works, and helped with the discussion, questions, moderated a discussion afterwards. So.
And is this this kind of week where you're not only all over the world, really, but and you're dealing with various, very different scales of discussion?
Right.
And obviously not everything design.
Right.
And probably much less design than one would expect.
This week was much less design.
Do you find, is this a typical week for you where you're sort of doing three or four wildly different things all at once?
Pretty much typical, but as and also I teach, so there's something I didn't do. I'm not teaching this semester, so usually my week entails about 2 days of teaching. So this fall has been unusual because I accepted a lot of events and lectures because I wasn't teaching.
I mean, this is also a question maybe even for both of you guys in terms of once you start not only running a practice and starting to teach, as you do as well, Tay, and then be a part of conferences and lectures and presentations, do you find it difficult to balance it all, or is it actually essential to have all these different inputs and outputs to kind of stay sane and stay connected? And what, I mean, basically, what is it like to, in that sense, because most people think you run a practice and that's sort of all you do, but obviously that's, you do so much, you guys do so much more than that. How do you balance all that?
Yeah, I think I mean, I love having lots of input, and I think just having lots of different things kind of running in parallel at the same time. So, like, this week we were doing a competition entry. Today I was, like, meeting with some friends to try and get another project moving forward. So I feel like there's not, it's not really, like, starting and ending something every week, or, like, you do one project to the next, and then you're like, oh, now I'll start the next project. But it's almost like you're doing a project in between, like, I don't know, like, 20 other things. And I think somehow that produces a momentum to do work more, like, more efficiently, but then also in a way that's, like, more exciting, because you're also, I don't know, like, inspired by other people that you're meeting every day and, like, talking in conversations. So I think that it's almost, like, necessary to have different forms of input and, like, traveling and teaching and, like, having all these sort of ways of, like, thinking about your work that are maybe not directly, like, sitting down and doing a drawing, but that there's some sort of, like, other space to explore.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think we have to keep all the balls in air, kind of, because we really don't know our future. Sometimes economy turns other way around, and some project may not go through, so we have to manage many situations in projects in general. But also, practice can be isolating, meaning, like, if you just stayed in your office, and which I love to do, but in a way that unless we make an effort to engage with the world outside of us, as many diverse type of people possible, we learn less. And as I get older and known, one can also contribute to relevant engagement with different communities and different stakeholders. So that's became a way of life and modus operandi, but it's a necessity, I think.
Yeah. Do you find, or have you found that as you've progressed in your career and the growth of your office and basically as an architect in general, that the all those extra activities actually become more diverse, that you're picking up more and more different types of things to engage in, or are you getting more focused?
First, you do diverse. You have to, because you have to find out who are the people you can have a dialogue with, and then what type of dialogue, where it goes, and then one needs to narrow down, because there's so much you can do. So you have to really choose to do what area with whom you engage in conversation and you, where you can really go into project based or deep dive and then make an impact. So in my time of life, I'm a little bit more focused. I don't do everything, but I have to say no to many things. But at the same time, for them to understand that I can't just do everything badly, but to do a few things well.
I think I'm at the opposite end of the spectrum a little bit. I think maybe sort of starting, it's sort of, for me, I'm sort of like saying yes, because you also don't know what the experience is yet or like what it's like to go to this kind of conference or work with these kinds of people. So I think a little bit it feels like a trial and error sort of situation where I'm like, yes, I'll try that. Like, let's see how it goes. And then I think if it works out, I think that's sort of part of the experience of like understanding how to narrow things down a little bit. But then I think also like finding what your niche is or like the kind of work that you want to do in the end. Like it might not be, I mean, we've talked about this a little bit, but like this idea of that maybe it's not fully client oriented. Like maybe you have a client oriented practice, but there's other kinds of work that you're trying to look for intentionally. And I think kind of trying to figure out what exactly that is and like what, how to sort of coordinate that work and make it happen, I think is sort of something at least that I'm sort of testing right now.
I mean, how much do you guys with each other ever discuss, or how often do you discuss the kind of how to position your studios or yourselves as architects?
Given that
you're at different sort of ends of the spectrum, I guess, in that sense.
I think sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes very specifically and sometimes more of a general. And, I think we have discussions like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what the last conversation you guys had about work-related stuff was?
I remember because she was absolutely overloaded in the summertime. Can't say no. So she's over the summer, she was preparing at least 3, if not 4 exhibitions, and you were doing competitions. Mm-hmm. And you were getting ready for teaching in 2 schools in 2 different countries. And this is completely overload. Like, you have to say no to one of them. Because she was saying, no, I can't, I have to do everything. So this is overload person.
That was a good talk.
Yeah.
That was real talk. Yeah.
And
it's like learning to say no.
One person I know in the city who has exhibition going in the city, 3 exhibitions at the same time. That's crazy. I've never heard of anyone like that.
And think of the people she knows. That's a lot coming from your mom.
Yeah. No, I think that was a useful talk. I think it's sort of about how to decide what you want to. I think it's part of the conversation was like how to decide on what you want to do and what you're willing to, what it sort of means to say yes, I think is maybe part of what the conversation was about.
But she's stubborn. She just.
You're stubborn too. Yeah. That's where I get my stubbornness. So. Very stubborn.
She doesn't really listen to me. She just does whatever she wants.
This is exactly where we wanted the show to go. Who identified that you were overloading first? You were. I'm looking at you and you. Obviously, nobody knows who I'm looking at when I say that. But
I think I did. But you, the way she's behaving is like definitely. She was feeling it.
I was feeling it. Yeah,
I was calling.
I don't think we even had a summer vacation really this past summer. I mean, it was like I'd have a couple of days, but it wasn't like I didn't have this like chunk of time where I could go away. It was really intense. Mm. I think you were sort of like, are you okay?
And on top
do
of
you
it,
do you want to go get tea?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. There were sort of like these, like, you got very motherly this summer.
Yeah?
I was like, okay. Yeah.
It's amazing.
Do you want to come see the dog?
Right.
He's kind of like a therapy dog also.
Right. So you want to go shopping.
Yeah. Shopping therapy. Yeah.
Have you guys, you mentioned before you worked a little bit together at Toshigo's office.
2 years, yeah.
Yeah, we called it homeschooling.
Yeah.
So after I finished grad school, I worked at the office at TMA for 2 years.
Yes.
I think. Yeah. For 2 years, like really specifically on this
one project.
This one house.
Yeah, but you did
private house.
One building. There were 2 buildings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you did one building from start to finish completion, and you did end up doing an entire construction documents for the other building. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Then in the middle, we did some work on the Venice Biennale.
Right. Yeah, and she did the work for me for 2012 Venice Biennale.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. The drawings.
And then I think I went to Houston.
Yeah. She went to Rice to teach.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Was this before you started your own practice, I guess?
Mm-hmm.
Or did you start it right after that?
I started it right after that, or like 2 years after that, maybe.
Right,
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like I was in after grad school, and then I went to Houston, and I kind of started the practice in Houston accidentally. But
it was accidental?
Well, it wasn't kind of like, oh, I'm going to start the practice, and like here's how I'm going to set it up. A project came in.
You just had a job.
Yeah, a project came in, and I was like, oh, I should make this official.
And pick a name.
Yeah. I need a name. I need a website. I need some liability protection. Yeah.
Did you already always know that Tay would start her own practice?
Yes.
But I don't think that the trajectory of me becoming an architect was very clear.
No, at all.
Well, not to me.
No. When she, really.
Set.
Am I in my hands? Let me check.
Yeah.
I don't know who's calling. Hello? Hi, Maya.
Oh, hi. Who's on the phone?
This is Dong. Let me put you on the radio. Would you like to be on the radio? Or do you want to just talk to Toshiko? Sure, no problem. Oh, man. No, of course. So Toshiko and Tay are here.
Hi.
I say hello. You can say hi real quick.
Hi, Maya. Hope you're feeling better.
Hi, Maya.
She says she's pretty wiped out.
Oh.
So don't feel any obligation to stay on the line any longer than you feel comfortable, of course. So we were just talking about them working together. We've already gotten to that point. So we're basically starting from today and working our way backwards. So we talked a little bit about what they did this week. We haven't even talked about really how their practices are run so much, but generally we just sort of go wherever the discussion goes, and the idea generally is to get to a point where we're talking about how each of them got their start, what it was like actually to build a practice, let alone figure out that you could make a living from architecture.
That's a real story for Maya, how she started. Yes.
So obviously you'd be an incredible guest, but obviously I understand you may need to, don't worry about it, we can bring you on another time as well. Of course. No worries at all. No, of course. I'm actually just happy you called.
Yeah.
Thank you. No worries at all. Do you want to talk to Toshiko real quick? Sure, one sec.
Oh, hi. Hi. Oh, hi, Maya. How are you?
That's okay. It's cute. Sorry, we just.
Oh.
Oh, that's.
Maya's talking to Toshiko right now.
Okay. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I don't think she'll be able to join for the proper conversation. Yeah. But it was very nice of her to call.
It's so nice of her to call.
Oh, another time. Okay.
I'm glad I answered. Usually I just ignore the calls that come in. I was like, oh, wait. Like, I was like putting it aside. And I was like, oh, shit. Well, you've never met her?
Oh. Mm-mm.
I hope you're feeling better. And
no.
See you soon.
But her museum's like right here.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's on, like,
it's on
Lafayette,
Lafayette.
The Chinese American Museum.
Oh, my God.
Okay. Or Center. Lafayette and Center.
Right.
It's like between
the
two.
Yeah. It's right here.
Okay, thanks for calling in.
It's snowing.
Yeah.
Whoa, that truck is like covered in snow.
She's on painkillers and everything. That's really tough.
She was worried she couldn't string a sentence together, but she sounded great.
Yeah. That's why she called in.
That's very nice of her to call.
Very nice. I know. She's feeling sorry, but she's groggy.
How did you guys meet, you and Maya?
I've known about Maya for, of course, a long time. And I don't know if she knows, but I was on the reviews in her undergraduate.
No way.
Yeah.
Really?
And Diane Lewis was her professor.
Oh, my God.
So I saw her.
Who's
her
my godmother?
Yeah.
Really? Mm-hmm. Amazing.
And then, so I don't think she recognizes me then, but we've been working together for Novartis project in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Maya is a master planner.
Amazing.
So there were 2-3 buildings and landscape, and I was selected to do one building. So we've been collaborating, and she's doing a building, and she's done a master plan in which she figured out the massing and position of my building.
Oh, wow.
So we've been really collaborating because 2 buildings are connected by bridge, and I ended up designing all the lab furniture systems in her building.
Oh, amazing.
And then since people go from one building to the other, we are very different, but we were like, really, I would do oak, and she would do eucalyptus, and then I would do 6-inch wide oak, and she would do narrower one. And so there's like, you can really see we actually thought through materials and details in 2 buildings, although it's different design, but there's connectivity.
And were you working or discussing with her anyway the whole time through the design process?
Yeah, and then we are also presenting together to the Novartis CEO and also the person in charge in Cambridge office, and also meeting with scientists. We presented together to Cambridge city planning people and to get the approval.
And those projects are open now?
Yeah, it's open. Yeah, oh, people have moved in as of last December.
Oh, congrats. That's amazing.
The park is designed by Michael van Valkenburg, open to public during daytime, so they can come in and have lunch there, and it's right off Mass Avenue.
Have you seen it, Tay?
I have.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was at a review at MIT.
Oh, okay.
And I went to get coffee.
Right.
And then I was like, oh.
There it is.
I know that building.
Yeah.
It, it was funny because I didn't know where, I sort of knew where it was, but I didn't realize that I would be so close to it.
Right.
And I literally went to the coffee shop like right down the street from the building.
Right, right. Flower.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I walked underneath Maya's building and I was like, oh my God, this is familiar.
It's on MIT campus. I mean, it's leased by MIT. Mm. So it's on MIT property where it's all the farmers are moving in. And it's the Silicon Valley of pharmaceuticals.
Right. Oh, pharmas. Yeah.
Not farmers.
I was like, farmers are moving in. Yeah. That's exciting.
Pharmaceuticals. Pharmas.
Can you, at this point, actually, maybe this is a question also for both of you, but Tay, at this point, can you recognize your mom's projects or design details, and is it really familiar? Like, oh, that's definitely something that my mom does.
Probably, I think so.
Yeah,
yeah, I think so. After seeing, I mean, you have like a diverse body of work, but I think there's kind of a consistency. There's definitely a consistency to what you do.
Yeah,
I think in terms of like the detailing,
right,
and the kind of strategies. Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, I think also working in the office, I became even more kind of familiar with detailing and that kind of approach to the work, for sure. But there's a project right here on Mulberry, no? Or in Mott?
Yeah, Mott, right. Mm-hmm. It's a building. Mm-hmm. It's on Mott Street between Prince and Houston. And it's on the east side of a building. It's very narrow front, but seven-story building. Oh. Yeah.
On Mott between Prince and Houston.
Yeah, on east.
Is it
I'm sorry, West Side. It's all commercial, but it's still maybe under construction. It's finishing it.
But the facade's there, no?
Facade is there.
Oh.
It's a granite facade, and it's kind of twist up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Do you recognize Tay's style?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you share a similar aesthetic or style or interest in terms of a form making anyway?
No, I think we're pretty different.
No, she's very different. Mm. She's very independent. And I can recognize it. Of course, it's generational, too. Mm. I mean, aesthetics change from generation to generation.
I was curious when you were working together, because I can imagine the tricky thing of working with a parent, but I somehow have never thought about working with a daughter. Was it any different or difficult or more exciting to have to be your DOS's, your daughter's boss?
It's very strange because she grew up with me. She knows the aesthetics. It was really easy to communicate. I say one thing and she kind of gets it. Hmm. So for me, it was like, oh my goodness, this is so convenient. It's like I don't have to explain one thing and she gets it. And if I say something, she can guess at it. She guesses at the right thing, the decision making. That's broadly based, I think, families has shared ethos and values.
Yeah.
All that. So that's kind of very easy because with other people, we have to train them from beginning. Because a lot of architects' work in design has a lot to do with decision making on values. Mm. And priorities, and then but she's got that set up. So,
I think also having a shorthand, maybe,
yeah.
You know, I think having a similar sets of references.
Yes,
you know, if you're talking about certain details or materials or like places to find material, I think there was sort of a shorthand that was weirdly existed.
Existed,
maybe we didn't know.
Yeah, existed. I know. But she traveled with that since she was 4 months old. So you've seen a lot of architecture. And then she's gone to a lot of lectures. Also, we never...
Not always willingly.
Unwillingly. No, complaining. Yeah. But she was exposed to it. Mm. But we never forced her to study architecture, nor discouraged it. We just let her, but we didn't want to be heavy-handed about it. But since me and my husband, her father... we are traveling, we're both architecture buffs, so we, instead of like amusement parks, we'll go and look at Palladio or something.
Poor kid. We did go to Disneyland though once.
Once.
Yeah, when I was eight. Yeah.
Did you request that?
That was my request.
Yes.
and SeaWorld. Yeah. I don't know how I convinced you to do that.
But then I don't know if you remember your comment about 8 years old. And she says, Mommy, I understand what this Disney is all about. And she says, what? We are lining up all the time to wait, and they're trying to sell us something. And she understood the motive is all the commercialism. So you refuse to buy Mickey's.
No way.
Yeah. You had Mickey Mouse before, but after that, you kind of saw through the entire, manipulation.
You're just anti-capitalist from like 8 years
old. Just
very
young.
Very young. Right, yeah. Right. She kind of saw.
Yeah,
right,
but I think you being a teacher, I went to school like right across the street from Cooper Union, like grade school.
Grace George,
and that's when my mother was teaching at Cooper Union, so I'd actually go.
After school,
I would just sit in the studio and do my work while you were doing desk grids.
Right.
Like as a second grader.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Uh-huh.
Or faculty lounge when amazing Raymond Abraham or Peter Eisenman or Jean Agrest or Levius Woods would come in and go and say hello. And one day, then I would do exhibition, in end of the year exhibition, and she would always come and hang out. And one day I couldn't find her, and I went looking. I found a John Haydock reading Baba's story to her in his office. He was babysitting for me.
That's amazing.
I was not like 14. I was
no, a lot younger.
Very young, yeah. It was like first grade or something.
First grade or second grade. Mm-hmm. So just running around.
Yeah, so it's kind of a portable child.
Yeah.
So it'd come to studio, and then we'd... Right. And then I'm also an only child, so I think we also did a lot of stuff together as a family.
And like, just take the daughter to school day, and sometimes she would spend the whole day with me, Cooper, and... If you recall, Edward Seckler is a professor at Harvard of historic preservation, is Professor Emeritus. He died 2 years ago. His widow remembered that when he lectured at Cooper Union, you were the one who helped advance the slide.
They put me to work.
Child labor.
Yeah. I had to make trees. I remember making trees for
the
models.
Uh-huh. Taking advantage of small hands of children.
Yeah. Well, the apartment we lived in, one of the earlier ones I remember is we lived on the top floor, and then my parents shared an office on the second floor. And so I could come home and then come hang out or run around in the studio and bother everyone, and then go upstairs and do my own homework and everything. So it was kind of like a live work. It's not like that anymore, but it was sort of a live work situation growing up.
So, I mean, it was an escapable architecture.
Yeah, but she would also say, like, she would come back from school and say, Mommy and Daddy, what are you doing? This is what I used to do at kindergarten. All you do is draw and make models. Why don't you do some work with grown-ups, too?
Did you ever deliberately or think you'd go into something else?
Yeah, I think...
Like reject architecture.
I would totally reject architecture for a really long time.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I went to liberal arts school, and I studied philosophy and, like, visual art. So I sort of thought I was going to do more, like, an art... Well, I mean, I guess I kind of like to think that I'm doing more something between art and architecture, but... I thought I wanted to do photography. I was like, I wanted to do documentary film. Like, I wanted to do all these different things. And I went to a school that didn't have a set curriculum, which was sort of dangerous because you could, like, do anything and then kind of try different stuff out. I don't know what it was. Something kind of turned at a moment, I think, after I graduated where I was like, maybe I should try this. Maybe I should try architecture, even though I'd been kind of, like, really resistant to it. And I think I took this one. I did it at the Intro Studio at Columbia, one summer, like the summer studio. And then I had a great professor and I had a really great experience. I was like, why don't I try this?
And it wasn't like, fine, I'll try it for you. Like, you actually wanted to try it.
I wanted to try it. Yeah, I wanted to try it. Yeah, I think.
But it's a typical for us was 2 a.m. phone call. And Mommy and Daddy, I decided to go to architecture school.
Was that a 2 a.m. phone call? What
it was. It was something like that. We were like, oh, my God.
Exaggeration.
maybe it's psychologically it's 2 a.m. or something.
Maybe you were traveling somewhere.
Yeah.
And that's why it was 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Do you remember your reaction when Tay said she was going to be an architect?
I'm like, thank God, finally, because I used to see her draw, and I'm like, why didn't she become an architect? Mm. She could draw plans, and she has intuitive understanding, and but I'm not going to force it. Yeah. So I'm like, oh my God, finally, because it's you see as somebody who teach that somebody who has talent and capacity, right? But you don't want to force it upon your own child.
Something that when Preeti and I and Tay were on the radio show before, a lot of the focus was being an Asian architect. And then we have also Asian women architect. Have you ever discussed, obviously, there's changes, obviously, since when you were coming up as a young architect and now that you're coming up as a young architect. Have you discussed any of the challenges or advantages or issues that you're facing that were different from when Tay you were facing now versus when Toshiko you were facing at around the same age?
I think it was really extreme when you were... It was really extreme. No, right. You were only... It was like you and Diane Lewis were the only women in your class at Cooper.
We ended up... We had a very high attrition rate at Cooper. Only one third of a class will graduate. So I think we ended up with just two of us who actually went through the entire first...
Two women.
Out of how large of a student body?
Well, it was small, so about 30. And then Diane got a tenure at Cooper, first woman. No, second woman, I think... Sue Gatzel got the first one, but as an architect. And I was the first one to get a tenure at Harvard GSD as a woman. So this issue of gender imbalance is much more acute than racial and balance for me. And so being at Harvard, being Asian woman is an accident. It's like, what? They didn't even pay attention to that fact until fairly recently, 10 years ago, I think.
A good friend of mine, Juana, teaches at Harvard.
Yes, yes.
And so she had forwarded me a letter that I think all the female faculty at the school had signed in support of the students.
Yes.
And I, it was weird because I realized up until then... the shitty architects list, the kind of Me Too thing had actually not come up in any of the interview discussions because I think we were focusing on the ethnic and the race side.
Right.
And since you're both teaching, is that still, I don't know how to put it, is it much more out in the open in terms of at least the discussion now in schools? Or is it still kind of a secret list that floats around?
It's out in open. And I was on a panel for Dean's discussion panel at AIA like 2 weeks ago because my dean just stepped down, and since I'm local, he asked me to attend. And there's a Ayla Berman, who's a dean at University of Virginia, she brought it up as an open issue. And visibly, it's not a comfortable issue to discuss. There were 15 people representing 15 schools. There are only four women on that panel. And I was very open to discuss, and Andrea Simic from Cornell was also willing to discuss Richard Meier issue with Cornell. Wow. And then I was discussing the facts that I think at my school, at Harvard, we probably have the largest number of people on that list. Students are upset. And then Ayla was very open about how do you deal with that, and how do you have a communication with the students, and basically how do you make them feel safe. So it's whole thing is there's also talk about policy and Title IX, and that's actually extreme case. You can bring a case of harassment, and you can imagine how it's been challenged for actresses to bring up cases against Harvey Weinstein and so forth. Its personal cost is very high. But those policies are in place for those extreme actions. But what we discussed is existence of microaggression and microviolence amongst each other. And then that is really embedded in the culture. You know, Dean Smanner, we openly said architecture has been elitist, wealthy, white men's profession for the longest time in this country. So culture is operated under that assumption, which is exclusive. It does not include the needs of diverse cultures in diverse sexual orientations, sensitivity. It's just this very narrow point of view. So, and then I think the letter Juana had read to you, we got together, we wrote it, and then after that we brought it to Venice Biennale. We had a flash mob. Mm. And one of our graduates, Caroline James, is very active. And so we organized international flash mob. So we got a lot of attention to press about that internationally. And then Francis Holzman brought up a motion through AIA chapter to change a code of ethics of AIA, in which it includes aggression and then harassment as a basis for losing license. So it's a behavior. So that's actually, that's been voted in nearly unanimously.
Amazing.
So the one, there's, you know how it is, there's so many delegates that there's only a couple of votes which didn't go through, but it may be an error or something, but it's that's never been, it's unprecedented. Everyone went for it. So as a profession, it took stock of it. And it was landmark decision making. So AIA has turned around and really focusing on it. And all the schools are really looking at it, but not every school is really thinking through. Because some schools are saying, like, oh, we don't have that too many people on our list. So that's not the case. That's not the issue. Mm. You should worry more because people are not speaking up. If people speak up, which is going into healthy discussion, because we are confronting it. We're taking stock. So we are trying to move forward from this horrible situation.
The change in the AIA language, do you know, did that come about from the AIA or was it coming about from student groups or universities putting pressure on the AIA?
It came from a college of fellows. Some of us are FAIA's fellows, the ones older with white hair and wigs. We've been like, we have power, but we haven't exercised it. So Francis Hausmann appealed to College of Fellows, listen, we are the elders, we are supposed to set example, but look at what students are doing. We have to act. Mm. And if we act, we collect all the signatures, we can gather together the momentum. So in a strange way, we figured out that, yes, grassroots is happening from students, but top-down has to be effective. So in a way, the College of Fellows, really amazing, nearly everybody signed up and then pressured the main chapter and each chapter, and then they have lobbied against all the delegates. Mm. So there's a lot of politics went in from top-down, which was supportive. Mm. So yes, it was influenced by students' activism, but it just went all the way through to the group, which does have a power to change.
I feel like that's one of the few recent examples I've heard of where the group in power or the kind of top down actually is the one also creating that change, not sort of pressured into it through optics or politics or something like that. Right. That's a very encouraging. Yeah. I'm so proud of architects.
Yeah,
in that regard, anyway.
Yeah, because it's just like, what are we? We just old foggies. I don't want to just sit around and get old and fat. And what are we, right? We have to do something. So Frances was kicking everybody's butt, which is great. And she says, I'm going to be the rebel now. So I'm saying, join us to be a rebel. We were like, oh my God. Luckily, I think that generation, we've gone through 60s. Mm. 50 years ago, we are there, 68. So everybody has that, luckily, remember that spirit, which was very helpful.
Yeah. I think also at least at GSAP, I think there were not as many people on that list, let's say.
Yeah.
But I think what happened is that people felt like they were on notice, or like, I think that there's a different, it seems like the culture, from my perspective at least, it feels like people are watching out what what they're doing, like in a Deskrit or in the studio. And I for me at least, it's been interesting because students, I think, feel like they have more of a voice somehow. Like, I think it's given them some sort of agency, like reaching out to professors, like reaching out to faculty and actually like saying something like, this thing happened to my friend. Can we do anything? Like these sorts of things, which I feel like never happened when I was in school. So I think it's sort of shifting different values in school. I mean, I think the shitty architecture men list was tricky because it wasn't, there was no names attached to anything necessarily about who is making the claims, so it's not totally actionable, but it feels like it kind of triggers a different sort of set of effects around it. So I think that there's sort of repercussions, but I also sort of feel like that generation, even, it doesn't feel like it's that different from our generation, but it does feel like there's this sort of desire to change things like that, or like labor practices, like forms of payment, like right. These sorts of things in practice that seem like really like necessary in how to like start their own practice now, like seeing what we've done even.
Because you said the percentage of women in senior positions in architecture, let alone leading firms, is still like crazily low. I was going to say, what do you do about that? But I mean, basically, what do you do about that? How are you guys, especially as teachers, I guess, what can you do and how do you talk to the students to try to alleviate that or change that?
You had no women ahead of you, right?
Right. So, well, what, there's a couple of things about it. I think what you call attrition rate is very high. We have majority women students in my school, and nearly every grad school, majority students are women, but then the percentage becomes teens in the architectural profession once they graduate. That statistic is a little deceiving because there are more women who go into construction and real estate businesses or retail businesses, related businesses, and some of them actually stay in academia. And that needs to be like figured out how to account for it. Mm-hmm. One, there's, for example, somebody who is very high up, Tishman Spear, Catherine Frawley, who is a GSD graduate. She's gone to construction. Of course, it's better paying jobs. And then you have more power to decide, build landscape. And many women go into construction instead of going into architectural design practice because, again, it's hands-on, it's more effective, pays better, benefits better. And people going in to work for retail, to design stores for cosmetic company or Gap or Uniqlo, things like that, because that's also for the same reasons. It's so, are women more flexible and smarter than men to figure out more diverse path? I think that's a big question. I think that never been figured out. So I'm not so sure if we should worry about women. I think we have to, architecture as a profession has a bigger problem than gender imbalance in which with diversification of modal practice. I think so they may not narrowly going into practicing orthodox practice of in offices, or some of the practices are not licensed, some are not member of AIA, so they fall out of the radar. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they are not practicing architecture. So I think there's two ways to do it, but the first way is to how to include in more of an orthodox practice. It's actually there's a direct way. Offices have to have a flexible policies, which also is for men as well as women, as to how to have a practice which has labor-intensive background and long hours, and how can you have a family even if you're a woman. And then, like my office, we have flexible hours, and we can actually make sure some people with kids, they work maybe 3 or 4 days, and then ability to be able to work at home to encourage people with families. And so that's, it's like how the practice can look at other practices, other professions, in which they, it makes it much easier, lifestyle. I think that's the first thing. And then also encourage women in other businesses such as an engineering, which is much worse than architecture. And there are many women in legal profession and also medical profession. And I think it has a lot to do with subsidiary businesses or associated businesses that increase women in a place.
Do you try to mentor women specifically, or?
Yes, I end up doing that, but sometimes unconsciously and sometimes consciously, yeah. And I think that's been, I think so, because you really, I didn't have mentors. I don't have any woman mentors at all. And luckily I had men who really understood and encouraged me, and there are no role models. So I'm conscious of that. So if somebody wants me to help them along, especially women, I always do.
Are you seeing with the students that you guys teach now, I think you mentioned something in terms of is there a growing interest in pursuing non-traditional architectural routes even while they're still in school?
Yeah,
definitely. I'm trying to think of my students that have kind of are even starting to go into traditional routes. I think it really feels like there's a big shift happening. But I mean, even just thinking about I think more practices that can be more entrepreneurial or more kind of self-initiated, like thinking through self-initiated projects and trying to really do projects that are like meaningful and intentional. It seems like that is more a space that, at least what I've been seeing, where people are sort of trying new things out. I don't know, the 9-to-5, 9-to, you know, or like 18-hour job days, I think seem less appealing for many of us these days, I think, too, especially if you think about, you know, I think I have plenty of friends who are at places like WeWork, you know, doing design work, but they are getting paid in like a completely different way than people who are here. So I just think the sort of the division around that is so extreme now, around people who are doing like traditional forms of practice versus people who are doing practice but within different kinds of infrastructures, essentially.
Do you remember when did you start your practice, Toshiko?
Mine, 1981.
And how long had you been out of school at that point?
5 years.
Did you always know you wanted to start your own practice?
Kind of, yeah.
And do you remember, one question we ask a lot of the guests is how you made your first dollar?
How I made the first dollar?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, especially in the practice, how did you get that first job? Where did that come from? How did you actually suddenly have a practice?
Because I did a thesis at Cooper Union called Places of Transaction, and I was very much interested in market. And at that time, there's a store called Henry Bendel's, used to be on 57th Street. It has a very innovative prototype of street of shops with smaller shops that look like series of markets. Mm. But now it's all brand. But then it was a very innovative idea. And a woman who ran it, Geraldine Stutz, was the president. And she kind of made it. It's an idea of a diverse designers. But also they look like a markets and they look like a pop-up. Mm. And then she's always introduced new fashion designers to give a new way to introduce them on 57th Street off Fifth Avenue. So it was a very exciting place. So I decided to show my thesis to her. And because John Hader kept saying, your thesis is great to say everybody, you have to get your thesis built. That's what he said. And of course, we believed him. And I said, and she said, oh, this is great, this is fantastic, but why are you seeing me? Because I think you should build one of those. And then she commissioned to do a first project, 165 square feet, and it was for Comme des Garçons. So that started, I did this 165 square feet store for a store in New York for Comme des Garçons, and I started getting a lot of boutiques.
And that was straight out of the thesis?
Yeah. There's a prototype for Cooper Union thesis was built.
So you were already, even in that, I guess, 5-year span before you started to practice, you were already working on your own projects
No, I was working for Edward Larrabee Barnes for a large office, and I working on things like IBM 590, like high, because I thought I just had to get large projects under my belt. I get licensed, everything. So I have like in my head, I have to get training. I wanted to go for work for Alvar Aalto, and I got ready, but when I graduated, he just died. You would have been a very different life.
Huh. Yeah. But you also worked for Noguchi at some point, no?
As a student, yes. I was working for Isamu Noguchi. Yeah.
That's crazy.
In Long Island City.
Yeah,
right?
In his studio. Mm-hmm.
That just sounds like fantasy talk. That's amazing.
But you have some good stories from that.
Right, because Bucky Fuller, he was partner with Bucky Fuller. So they shared office together. And they have a company called Noguchi Fountain and Plaza Inc. And they would go after public projects like parks and things. Then he is a sculptor, so I would say I was drawing plans and things like that. So, and then it was very interesting atmosphere. There's Long Island City. There's no place to eat, so every person is responsible for doing a lunch, and we take turn. And cooking lunch. So he has his friends and clients. They come, you have to cook for like at least a dozen people. And you have to go buy food and cook there and then serve it. So that's part of our duty. And then so we all, like a big family, every lunch was a very nice meal. He has curators, his collaborators, artists, friends. And Bucky and Noguchi, they would always fight because Noguchi believed everything natural, and then Bucky believed in everything artificial, man-made, technology.
Do you see, this is when you were still at Cooper.
Yeah.
Are there, that kind of culture specifically, that sort of, it seems very familial and very collective and even just making lunch for everybody. Does that exist in New York anywhere anymore? I mean, I feel like that exists maybe in
Europe. Yeah,
Europe.
European firms. I think Snohetta does that sometimes.
Yeah, and Big does it all the time. They have a kitchen. Olaf Joy Eliasson.
It's not so prevalent, I guess, in the smaller New York firm kind of world.
Yeah. Or Chinese practices, they have that.
They do?
Yeah.
Oh, in China.
China, like in Ai Weiwei's office, they always had a cook and still come and make lunches and Yang Ho Chang and. I think Chinese practices say that.
I feel like our small offices need to combine into a bigger space that has a kitchen. Basically big enough where we have a kitchen.
Yeah.
Totally. Like that's the goal. I'm kind of like none of the shared workplaces that are geared towards designers and architects seem to advertise a big kitchen.
Yeah, it's always like shared printer.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they should like gang up on that.
And how did your Houston project come about?
Let's see, that happened through a friend, a family friend that I knew who was, at the time he was like the vice president or I think the vice president of the Big Brothers Big Sisters Houston Association. Now he's actually the CEO of the whole Big Brothers Lone Star State, which is all of Texas. But he's like about my age and he kind of was like, we need a new space. You know, he approached me thinking that we needed they needed sort of a new design for fundraising, essentially. So I was like, okay, I can do that. And then we put together a design in like, I don't know, like about a month. We like researched and just like interviewed people and that kind of thing, and sort of gave them images that they could use for fundraising. And then about 2 months later, he called and he was like, we need construction drawings.
You're like, what?
Yeah, like at the end of the summer, he's like, we need construction drawings. And then everything kind of just like. Went really fast from there. And that's when I was like, things got really real. And that was a little crazy because it was like, basically I had these two great students from Rice who were amazing. But you know, school had started again. And so it was kind of like me and my laptop a little bit, trying to sort of figure out how to balance and do things. So it was kind of like, yeah, starting like 0 to 100 a little bit. So yeah, it was super lucky how that happened.
Were you looking to your mom for advice and studying a practice? Or were you just letting her like swim on her own?
Yeah. Swim well.
Sink or swim.
You're like, good luck.
There's definitely a sink or swim mentality too.
Yeah. I think
it's good because then I guess it forces, like I definitely make a lot of mistakes as a result. because it is sort of a sink or swim, like, try it, see how it goes.
But it's amazing how first project is like 70,000 square feet.
It's
right?
20,000 square feet.
I thought it was 70. 20, no, no. Anyway, it's big.
Yeah.
For project to stand out. It looks like 70,000 square feet. It has a huge presence.
It does look really big.
Yeah.
It is huge looking.
It's big, and from the highway, it's pretty visible.
Yeah. So it has this presence and impact.
It has a 70,000 square foot personality.
Yeah.
It's a big personality. Yeah. Colors and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think it was good. I think that there's, I think it's interesting. It's sort of some, it's like hands off. I think that, you know, we sometimes talk about work, but there's also sort of hands off.
Yeah.
I think also letting me make mistakes and kind of trying to figure out things organically. Because I think if you sort of follow a certain protocol, it's, I don't know. Yeah, I think that if you gave me advice about everything, I think that.
Yeah, I don't.
That seems very foreign.
Yeah.
There was, I think you mentioned it a little bit about the interest in initiating projects from the students, and I mean, even hearing about how you took your thesis project and got it made, got it built, found the person to pitch it to, and actually moved it forward. And a lot of your work today, obviously, now is actually sort of initiated in a lot of ways, and actually things you think should happen, could happen, would be interesting, and just putting it out there in the world. With a lot of the guests, I think speaking with a lot of guests, there's that sort of theme of making stuff when nobody was really asking you to do something, and especially in a service industry like architecture, it always feels kind of rare to me. But it's interesting that seemingly you guys both obviously have related in some way. Is that something that, like, I guess asking Toshiko, was that something you instilled in Tay, do you think, or was that something that your family even did as you were growing up, or is that even as you were coming up, the idea to basically push an idea and not wait for someone to ask you, not wait for an allowance, I guess, to do something?
I don't know as a fan. Well, also, her father, Jamie Carpenter, he's like a self-made glass artist, but he's kind of did a research, invented his own ways, and a lot of times what he does is he is approached by some project, but he will come up with something else. And then it's very creative in terms of concept and ideas, and people might come up with just one piece of glass, but he'll think about entire effect around a piece of glass, which becomes a space or becomes a building. So he has this inventive spirits that, so it's just not, she's like half me, the other half is this, he has this brilliant ideas about conceiving small things, but in a much more larger scale context. And I think I see a lot of you, your work, and Jamie's work related to it. It's not just me, but there's that other aspect.
But I think, yeah, I think definitely there's this sort of combination, but I think, I feel like you've also had this sort of more social bent in the work that you've been doing.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe in the past 10 years or something. Like I think the project you did in Senegal, for example, is sort of itself initiated with something like the Alpers Foundation, right?
Right.
That sort of has this other way in which architecture can kind of operate more socially, you know, as it's like a it's for a nonprofit.
Right.
I think some of the work you've been doing too with like Vision Arc.
Yeah. The research.
So I think the sort of idea that there's some other way in which architecture can be accounted for or like exist in the world that's maybe not, there could be a client involved, but there's some other like social good attached to it. I feel like that's, I think that definitely comes out of some of the work you've been doing for sure.
Right, right. Well, so I think, as you said, architecture is considered to be, if it's just a service industry, we are no different than dry cleaners, not to belittle dry cleaners. They do great.
Probably
job.
Need them more than architects.
Yeah. I know. So, like, if you, only thing they do is process through other people's programming concept and what was in a receiving end. Is there anything we see with the training that can contribute? Do we actually see a blind spot in a society like your pool, right? That's definitely, why didn't anyone else think about it, right?
Yeah.
Things well, that exist.
Yeah. I think, Dong, what was the title of your lecture at NJIT? It's like, nobody...
Doing, wait, was it?
I was like, nobody asked me to do this. Or something.
Yeah, nobody asked for this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Such a good title.
Although I guess it's kind of like Jesse, I guess, asked for it. He did ask me to come out, I guess. Yeah. It's a bit of a lie.
But yeah, I think that the blind, I think that's like a perfect example of the kind of blind spot.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And I think they are, like, as we work and observe the society and world at large, we see that opportunities, and then those are blind spots, a trigger point in society, which has a huge impact in terms of healing. And I think our training as an architect is very suitable.
Mm. Yeah, I think also just projects like the pool, or like trying to find projects to do in the city, it's also like fun. Mm-hmm. You know, like collaborating and like working with people that maybe you wouldn't necessarily work with all the time. Like, I think there's also this sort of, like we were talking earlier about like the isolating effect of like having a practice in like this office, but I think also like the beauty of being able to collaborate with people who you maybe wouldn't work with, or like who do different things. I think that's part of, for me, that's been part of the fun of like also initiating projects, like Dan and Chris who were here earlier, just like being able to talk through ideas that maybe you wouldn't ever come up with on your own, but like through sort of dialogue, other things happen.
And I do feel like there's at least in the current generation that kind of facility with social media and actually communicating in different ways, there's a lot more avenues to just put work out there,
right?
And actually discuss and have conversations with people that are on the other side of the world and things like that. But I like hearing that there's, I mean, maybe I'm a little too linear on this theory, but I like that there's a connection with even how you started your practice. There was nobody asked for that. Like there, you willed it to happen in a lot of ways, in this very exciting way. And it still seems, especially when there's no role model when you're growing up, or role model as you're starting a practice, it's always so encouraging, I think, to hear people just doing it anyway. It's really nice. Do you guys have any questions you want to ask live in the air to each other that you've never asked? As we wrap up, you can think about it. You can always come back to the mic too if you want.
Well, I was actually, well, what I thought Maya was going to be here, I was sort of thinking, because Maya has two daughters also, and they're both also mixed.
Yes.
Right? They're Chinese American. No, I was just kind of thinking about the way in which you both came up as women and as like Asian, you know, as, you know, women of color, and just sort of thinking about whether that's influenced you at all as like mothers, like raising daughters in the world, just sort of out of curiosity.
For me, really not, except that I was very careful to expose you to a culture. So I didn't want you to be homogenized. And so you understood the values and the cultural asset of Asian, and for me, the Japanese. And I wanted you to experience it and know it, and food, taste it, so it becomes part of it. Because otherwise, if you're not very careful, you could be, the forces, inertia from Americanization, Westernization is so huge that you could just grow up and not knowing what that is. And then perhaps some ideas or values may not exist anymore. And it's very subtle. And I think the idea of dealing with people, how you react and act in a society as human being, is, as an Asian, is very different. So I didn't tell her, but I, as a mother, I tried to really bring her into occasion and show her as an example how to deal with situations. It's, everything is very necessarily visible and very subtle. But then I kind of see it, and I may give you a tough time correcting certain way of saying thank you to people, or
thank you notes.
Like always writing thank you notes right away, handwriting. That's also true in America culture too, to be showing gratitude idea all the time, which is very fundamentally Asian and Japanese, a gratitude for food you receive and anything. You'll be a recipient of amazing wealth of goodness in society, and that humble attitude about self is kind of fundamental. So it's that kind of more, how do I say, behavioral things is something. And then, of course, I had to expose her to all the Japanese food and how to cut fish and tempura, right? You say how to cook rice, all that basics. It has to have it, right?
Yeah. Look at that. You've done a food workshop on the last Friday.
Yeah.
Fish. You could pick fish up down the street. Yeah. It's funny, though. I've also always thought of you as, like, a New Yorker.
Yeah.
Like, as an identity, I feel like. So you came when you were, like, 14.
Yeah.
To America from
Kobe. Yeah, I'm New Yorker, yeah.
Yeah, like, the sort of identification for me, for you, has always been, like, you're a New Yorker.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah, I'm a New Yorker.
I mean, I don't know if you, I mean, I know you identify as being, like, Japanese also, but I think there's something about a New York identity that is also sort of its own species in some sense.
Yeah. And she's a New York kid. Mm. She grew up in Manhattan.
I guess you guys are the third and fourth, let's say, New Yorkers that we've had on the show. We actually have most people are kind of from somewhere else and then are relatively recent transplants. But what's interesting is I noticed every single one of the New Yorkers, it never really crossed their mind that they couldn't do something. Like couldn't do something interesting, couldn't put themselves out there in some way. Whereas almost everybody else, even though there was always this nagging doubt or there's always like hurdles to overcome. I think it was one of the Alans that came in. I asked if he had always known he wanted to start a business. And he was like, of course, doesn't everybody? And I was like, actually, I think you may be the first person. Everybody else is like, no, I never thought I could start a business. And it seems like such a New York thing, not necessarily to start a business, but to do something unique or to do something on your own or to do something that you want. And it's such an amazing thing about thinking about the city. Mm-hmm. It never occurred to me that amazing aspect when you were growing up was so prevalent amongst virtually no matter what borough they grew up in, actually, just because they're surrounded in a city where people are doing incredible things and they see incredible things. And their parents are usually very encouraging about that.
I think kids see parents, and nearly every parent is like self-made. A lot of self-made people in the city. They see their own parents and friends' parents and different lifestyles, and just gives kids the idea that anything is possible. Mm. You start, and people grow up, and it takes over. Mm. So I think New Yorkers, as kids, they know to go and take over. Mm-hmm. That's the purpose of life.
Now's your time to take over. thank you guys so much. This is something. Yeah. This has been really wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. This is such an awesome idea, Dong. This whole
saying is such a great service. So inspiring. Thank really you fun. For the opportunity.
Yeah, thanks for coming by. Yeah,
it's been fun. Our first interview.
First interview.
I know.
Thanks. Enjoy the snow.